You're on the Plants Grow Here podcast. I'm Daniel Fuller. Come along with me as we enter a hidden world of deep horticultural, ecological, and landscape gardening knowledge with featured experts, industry professionals, and enthusiasts. If you subscribe to the Plants Grow Here podcast, you're obviously dedicated to upskilling and soaking up as much industry-level wisdom that you can. This week, you're in for a real treat. Usually we like to stick to one topic per episode, but in this episode, we're going to explore over a dozen topics quickly. Karen Smith, my mentor and editor for this episode's sponsor, Hort Journal Australia, gives us her top articles from the magazine last year. We go over the work of some of the country's best horticulture industry writers and touch on the lessons learned. Some of the topics include predatory insects, emerging pest problems, careers, AI, and much, much more in this jam-packed, hour-long interview. Welcome back to the show, Karen.
Hi, it's been such a while since I've done a podcast. I almost feel a little bit rusty.
Don't worry, we'll get through it together.
I'm sure we will. Bit like riding a bike.
A little bit like writing an article too, Karen.
Yeah, it is too. That's for sure.
So, Karen, speaking of articles, we're going to be going over a few of your favourites. Now, I know that it's hard to pick a favourite because they're all so different in every issue.
Yeah, it's really difficult sometimes to pick a favourite because, you know, there's so many great articles. But, I think maybe if I pick out the ones that I think are particularly relevant and, well written, they're nearly always well written, but there you go. So, all right, shall we take it away from the first issue of the year, which was February, because we have 11 issues a year. The December-January is a combined issue, so we start our year in the February issue.
Absolutely. But before we get there, can you tell us about, like, that December-January issue is kind of a special issue, isn't it? Like, that, a lot more eyeballs seem to go on that one for some reason.
Yeah, you're exactly right, and it's really a good issue to be in if you want your information to get out there, because over that time, December, January, is usually when most of our industry, particularly January, over the festive period, Christmas and everything, people actually have a little bit of a downtime and spend more time reading the magazine and have a good thorough read of it. So, it is a bit of a special one to be in, I think. Advertisers should remember that.
Absolutely. So let's move on now to that February issue for last year, 2023.
Yeah, so there's a really great article called Good Bugs Are No Quick Fix. And it's written by Dennis Crawford, who some of your listeners may have heard you do podcasts with in the past. He's an entomologist and there's nothing he doesn't know about bugs. So what he's actually talking about in it is, you know, if you decide to move into biological control, particularly in a nursery situation where you might have hundreds of thousands of plants, you're not going to get a quick fix straight away. You know, it takes time, and if you've been using a lot of chemicals, you need time to ease out of that. So it's sometimes a bit of a slow process to get started. But once you do, you know, get into it, it works really well. Just to give a little bit of a quote, he says that biological control goes back a long way. In fact, it precedes the modern pesticide-focused era of horticultural and agricultural pest control. That's so true. And so often, you even when you're watching some of the garden shows, they'll talk about a remedy that they've used, or, you know, which type of insects will control others with beneficial insects. So I'd have to say that was really a good way to start the year, being in that first issue of the year.
Mm, absolutely.
Yeah. So.
So no quick fixes.
No, there's not, but certainly even in my own garden I haven't used chemicals for such a long time, and I do have loads of spiders around, but, you know, they do a lot of good as well. And as Dennis often says, not all bugs are a pest. So, you know, sometimes they're, you know, it's the beneficial insects that you're seeing. And while sometimes, you know, people might get a bit freaked out by the odd spider web, you sort of, it's a bit of an indicator that you've got a nice, healthy garden.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd like to share something that happened in my garden recently, Karen.
Yeah.
So I've recently planted some kangaroo paws in my Brisbane relatively heavy clay garden. They said it couldn't be done, but I'm doing it. Now, first thing that happened was that first flush of flowers, a bunch of grasshopper-looking things, I'm not an entomologist, they look like grasshoppers to me, moved in, and they're munching all those flowers. So the flowers looked a bit unsightly. They're sort of chewed down to the nubbin, and being an eco-gardener, I just left it. And then what I noticed happening was the skinks moved in. And now those skinks seem to be doing a really good job of decimating those caterpillars. Now, so the second flush, after I removed the dead ones, came through completely unharmed. So the skinks are doing, I think it's the skinks that are doing the job. Now they're back again. And then now I watch the skinks having their go again. So it's definitely like a bit of a boom and a bust cycle in the garden.
Yeah, that's true. Mm-hmm. It's a nice, healthy garden. And I think for people, particularly businesses, if they're going down the path of integrated pest management, there's all sorts of benefits in for their staff. You know, it's time saving because they haven't got people walking around spraying chemicals and having to get suited up and all that type of stuff. So there's lots of benefits to biological control and integrated pest management.
Absolutely.
Okay, so that was February.
So let's move on to March now. So what's the editor's pick for March, Karen?
Well, there's a terrific article written by Chelsea Payne, and Chelsea is from the Western Australian Parks and Gardens, Kings Park. She's the curator of arboriculture, and in Western Australia they've had a big problem with what they call PSHB, Polyphagus shothole borer. And the title of the article is PSHB, the perfect invader. So what it actually does is it's a little borer that actually gets into all the stems and trunks of trees and burrows and makes these little tunnels all the way through, creating little galleries where they farm fungus and produce offspring. So it's quite a serious problem over in WA. So she also talks about what to look for, says multiple small holes on the trunk and stems, which are around 1 to 2 millimetres in diameter, an unusual decline or death of some stems, and then you'll see the frass that you know, the sawdusty stuff that you see with most borers. And there's a dark inky stain around where the borer holes are, which is caused by a fusarium fungus. So she says to monitor trees, and in Western Australia they've got a free app called My Pest Guide. It's a resource that they can use to help with the identification, and says if you suspect that you have it, you need to look at the location, and there's a number there that you can ring with the Department of Agriculture. So we need to keep on top of these things because we don't want them spreading all the way around the country. So, I think, you know, these sorts of articles are really good for the broader community, particularly because our magazine goes to industry. You know, it shows there's some great images there. It shows people what to look for, and, you know, if they see it and identify it or want help getting it identified, there's resources available. So I thought that was really relevant. And so that's a year ago, and I read something, I think I heard it on the news about that Polyphagus shothole borer. So if anyone's concerned about it, go to the March issue, pages 14 and 15.
Wonderful. So, yes, another interesting pest article. And that's probably one that maybe if you're not in Western Australia, you haven't heard about. And hopefully if we do things right, you probably won't hear about it. In, you know, all things going well.
Yes. Okay, so now we move into our April edition. And this article is written by Dan Austin. Now, Dan's a lecturer at TAFE South Australia, and he's also the editor of a magazine for the International Plant Propagators Society and an author as well. So he's well qualified to be talking about this particular topic. The heading is Jumping the Garden Fence When Wonders Become Weeds. So, you know, he's talking about different plants that can quite easily become a weed. So for people who may be listening who are designers or landscapers looking at, or even people working in a nursery and giving ideas to people about what to plant, he mentions a website that people can go to, or a database called Grow Me Instead. Now, just this morning, I heard somebody talking about Thunbergia grandiflora, which is a it's been a weed for a long time, beautiful climbing plant, but I have often seen that for sale in nurseries. So, you know, these websites like Grow Me Instead talk about, well, if you're thinking of growing a plant that looks like that, maybe we can offer you an alternative to put in its place.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, when weeds get out of control, particularly in bushland, it affects everything, you know, including all the microfauna or the fauna around the place as well. So we don't want these weeds, these plants becoming weedy and damaging all the native plants that local wildlife might feed on or harbour. And I know you work with a lot, or you've interviewed a lot of people on that particular topic yourself, haven't you?
Yeah, I have. And the interesting thing is it's a lot more nuanced than what you might think. Like native plants, for example, can be very weedy. We have Penicetum alipedes. I can't remember what the species name is, but it's a native grass. There's also one native to South Africa, but our native Penicetum can be quite weedy, especially if you select stock that's grown by seed. So if you select like a cultivar like Nephrae Penicetum, it actually is very low seed setting because it's grown by tissue culture, by cloning. So it's not selected by that seed prolific ability.
Yeah, that's right. And I suppose if you think about growing native plants, it's really no longer considered a native if it's not grown in the area that it's native to. So hence why a lot of revegetation happens with provenance plants. And so if you're taking a plant that grows in one side of the country and planting it on the other, it's like moving a plant from Spain to Turkey, isn't it?
Absolutely. And also you can muck up the local genetics too. So not only are you creating like a separate weed, you can also severely damage the genetics of the existing population.
Okay.
Once, you know, bees and pollinators take pollen from one plant to another. So I know in Cranbourne Gardens in Victoria, our native Australian Botanic Gardens in Victoria, they have they're not able to grow Hardenbergias because there's a native Hardenbergia which is not very spectacular compared to what they'd probably want to grow there, and they don't want to mess up the genetics of that native population, so they just don't grow it.
Yeah, very interesting. Yeah, so anyway, well, if people are interested, they can go in and read Dan's article. Now I just close the page to tell you the number.
It was the April edition.
Yes, it was the April edition, and it's page 30 and 31.
Wonderful. Let's move on to May.
Okay, so in May, there's a lovely article written by Karen Lau and Steve Warner. They are landscape architects, and their business name is Outhouse Design. And they've written about a wellness garden and the essence of flow. So they look at all, they talk about the elements of mindfulness and the sense of place and being present within the garden. And, you know, there's such a lot of talk today about getting off devices and off social media and having space and time to actually relax and have downtime. So this particular garden, what they're saying is you don't have to have a quarter acre block to create a lovely space where you can sit back and take a moment in the garden, because not everyone has a quarter acre block, but sometimes people can even make an area like that on a balcony with some beautiful plants and a nice seat and good lighting. So, you know, they talk about all the different ideas that you can use to create that, and they talk about rehabilitation gardens, a project that they've worked on. So I know that that particular company has done a lot of work in that arena with big organisations, rehabilitation centres and things. So that article's on pages 20 through to 22.
Wellness gardens, therapeutic horticulture. We're really starting to clue into this stuff now, aren't we?
We certainly are. In fact, there's a therapeutic horticulture conference coming up soon up in Noosa, I think. Noosa. Yeah, not far from you.
No, not far from me at all.
Lucky duck.
So now we can move on to the June edition. So what was – so each, and also I feel like we should touch on as well that each edition has a sort of a focus. Now, that doesn't mean that every article within that edition speaks to that topic, but it's just a bit of a general
– theme.
A general theme.
Yes, yes, we do. So each month we have a different theme. So so we have a feature writer who will write on that particular topic, but quite often the other writers, contributors, may weave a bit of that topic into their article. So, I mean, for example, if I said to you the article feature this month is advanced trees, and I gave three people or four people that topic, they would all write something completely different from coming from a different angle, if you know what I mean.
I know exactly what you mean. So one person might write about how to source those established trees from nurseries. Maybe what another person would talk about, you know, like, for example, if I was writing about it, I'd probably talk about arboriculture careers and how you can get to work with established trees.
Yes, I was actually just going to say that, that, you know, with your article on careers, because horticulture is so diverse, you know, we've often tried to fit your topic in around that feature for the month. So looking at our June issue, you've actually written about introduction to sports turf management. So each month you've had a different topic that educates people, particularly people who might be looking to start a career or have a change in career within the industry. They can then read your articles and think, well, this sounds like it could be interesting for me.
I think turf is one. A lot of people don't find turf exciting, but I think for the right person, a career in turf is amazing. And I find a lot of people who were like athletes in high school or maybe even in uni, they tend to gravitate towards turf because it, you know, you can be on the field and you can be a part of it. Not everybody who's working on that sports field is actually the one who's, you know, kicking the footy. Like there's a lot more people who get to work within that industry.
Yeah. Oh, and you can't deny there'd be a lot of people out there dying to get on a ride-on mower.
Yeah, and some of the machinery that they get to work on is much more exciting than, you know, your zero turns. Like they have some pretty cool machinery.
Yeah. okay, so then in June, there's a fabulous article written by Michael Casey, and Michael writes regularly for us on green infrastructure. And on this particular article, it's called Exploring Substrates, No Substitution for Future Infrastructure Projects. And that's on page 6. So because as you can imagine, when you're talking about green roofs, for example, they have to consider the weight that's involved in bringing in soil. So what type of medium do they use for when they're building and constructing those projects? And as opposed to perhaps a green wall, it could be completely different again. So he talks about green roofs and green walls, planter boxes, for example, and some of the images show how they crane a lot of this, the product up on the top of high-rise apartments and on their balconies and everything. So, you know, it's quite a complicated process, and you can't afford to not get it right. So Michael's a bit of an expert in that field of infrastructure, and actually he's an advisor to the Green Infrastructure Board, so or organisation. So, so that's another great article, page 6, 7, 8 and 9. So that's actually a 4-page article.
Michael had a really good talk at the AIH conference last year, and I know you missed it, Karen, but he was making the point that often as horticulturists, we get left out of the initial stages of planning. And what that means is that landscape architects who have a really good idea of how to design, you know, spaces, and engineers who know how to put the science together and make sure that it doesn't fall down, but they don't know about the plants. And so then they get to the end stages, and then the horticulturist has to come in and say, well, no, we have to go back to the drawing board.
Yeah.
So he's saying we should be there at the first stages.
Oh, I agree 100%. And, you know, you often see it with new houses being built around the place. By the time they get to the end stage, they don't want to spend the money, and the builder gets his labourers to plant out, and you see all the plants over time die because they've buried the crown of the plant, you know, little things like that. And that's just on a small scale. So when you're looking at big scale infrastructure, it's 100% important. So
absolutely.
Now in the July issue, whilst we have all those other same writers writing each month on their topics, and they're great, we also attend a lot of shows and expos and conferences and that type of thing. And on page 21, John Fitzsimmons attended the landscape show down in Caulfield at Sandown Park. And so he's talking about innovation and sustainability. So he's gone around and looked at, you know, all the different exhibitors and talks about what, you know, what products are there. And so for people that can't get to those events, if we can cover it in the magazine, they at least get a bit of an idea of what it was like and see a few images and that type of thing. So it's good for us too to be at these events, because we get to know people and get to know what's out there, because we're having to constantly come up with reinvent ourselves every month with new topics and that sort of thing. So he's showing some really interesting products there that get used in the landscape field. And of course, you've also that's on page 21 through to 23. So 21, 22 and 23, and it's called Innovation and Sustainability at the Landscape Show by John Fitzsimmons.
Now, I was there as well with John, and I had a walk around for the podcast. I couldn't agree more with the topic that John chose. So sustainability was such a big theme there. It just seems like that's really at the forefront of everybody's minds. I think maybe a few years ago it was like a fringe thing where it was like, okay, environmental greenies. It's not like that anymore. The whole industry is thinking this way now.
Oh, definitely. And they have to. Wait till you read John's article in the next issue, which will be the March issue. It's fantastic what's happening overseas. It's, you know, the fact that these huge companies are putting so much money into technology in our industry is just mind-boggling. And also in that July issue, of course, you complemented that with your Building Your Career in Landscape Construction. Well done, Daniel.
So what was the theme for that one? It was landscape, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think it was, because just about everything's written on landscape. Yeah. So sometimes we look at, in that issue, we've even written on phytohormones and bush foods. So, yeah, it covers, it's sort of more about the production, I suppose, of plants and what plants to use in the landscape.
So what was the August theme, Karen?
August was fertilisers and integrated pest management, believe it or not.
That's a very broad thing, isn't it? And they do work together, just like all aspects of
the Yeah. So I'd have to say your article, Nursery Retail Careers Between the Grower and the Garden, which is on page 32, was really good, because often it's the person working in the nursery that is the face of horticulture. Because mm-hmm. where do people go when they want information or want to buy plants? They go to a retail nursery. So you've actually talked about the different qualifications that are retired. And I must admit myself, I started out my horticultural career working in a retail nursery, and it really did give me a great start to my career in horticulture. So that was really good that you chose that particular topic that month, because we also had an article in there from John Stanley talking about retail into the future. So that really worked really well.
Mm-hmm. It's a special part of horticulture, isn't it? I don't remember writing that between the grower and the garden, but it's so true about that role.
Yeah, well, it is, because you know, the grower is producing the material, but you're probably aware you can go into some places that sell plants and they're just all sitting on a rack and that's it. But really good retail nurseries really know how to display it. And I must admit, I took pride in creating lovely displays, and in fact people would then just come in and take everything off the display, and I'd say to the boss, oh no, let's wreck my display, and he goes, good, you can build it again, you know. So yes, certainly working in retail is a hugely important field in the broader industry, because they're the ones selling all the plants to the customers and explaining how they grow, you know, because when you do work in a retail nursery, people come in and want to know, oh, they tell you what their garden is like and how, where the shade is, what parts get sun, what don't. And you can, in fact, these days people, I should imagine, it didn't happen in my day. They might have bought in a photograph in my day, but today they can come in with a few pics on their phone and say, this is what it looks like. They can bring in a sample of their soil and you can test it and take it from there by giving some sound advice on what they can plant. So, yeah, it is a field that you do have to have some pretty good communication skills as well to be talking to clients.
Oh, yeah. And that hort knowledge too.
And definitely the hort knowledge.
When someone comes in and they give you a photo of like a burnt crispy leaf, how you have to have a troubleshooting process to go through to figure out maybe 5 or 6 questions that you need to ask them to help eliminate some of those things that it's not and narrow down to what is going wrong.
Yeah.
It's a difficult job.
Definitely. So,
or a challenging job, rather.
Yeah, and, you know, you tend to get people that want to go and be served by the same person each time and, you know, so you get your little favourites, or they get their favourites, you know, and the pride that people come in with and say, oh, you know, that plant you sold, those plants you sold me to do, you know, my front garden, they just look fantastic. And I'd say to them, bring in some photos, you know. Yeah. I mean, sometimes they'd say, oh, can you pop in on your way home? And they, you know, they're so proud of it. So it's lovely to, it can be a lovely area to work in hort.
Absolutely. And so you've got your regular retail nurseries, like maybe like the Big Green Shed, or maybe your local like endemic native nursery or something like that. Like there's so many different things you can go into.
Oh,
or
yeah.
the garden centres, which are very, like, that's where we all go on our weekends and on our first dates. And, you know, I go there with my wife to our local garden centre to have a cup of coffee and have a wander around and try not to buy every plant that I see.
Yeah, exactly. They've certainly come a long way with having little cafes and that type of thing in them, because it becomes a destination. And, it's great. It's certainly in those independent garden centres you get the best advice. I know my local only employs qualified people, you know, or they train them up, you know, put them on as an apprentice or trainee and work them up through the business so that, you know, they're keeping an eye on their progress and helping them get through their studies and that type of thing. So, yeah, I won't mention where I heard this, but I was somewhere recently and a person asked about a particular plant, and the person serving said, oh, yes, well, it says plant in morning sun, or something or other, and, oh, you can Google that and have a look and find out what that means. And I thought, oh, just say, look, I'm not sure, because I'm not qualified. I mean, hats off to the person was trying really hard to be nice to the customer. That's the fault of the employer, not the employee, because there's no training involved.
Yeah, the sunlight thing is pretty basic, isn't it? That's really probably step two after soil.
Yeah. So sometimes choosing the right staff is important as well. Well, always.
I feel that we should clarify what that means too, Karen. Like that sunlight thing, different companies will have different terminology, you know, like full to part sun or heavy shade or part sun, part shade. It's like it can all sound so different.
Yes.
Like, let's talk about what we mean there with those different terms.
Well, if it says, usually when I look at a label, if it says part sun, that tells me that it won't take full sun. So I would look at putting that in an area where it gets morning sun, where it's not as hot, whereas afternoon sun can be blazing.
Yeah, and full day sun, like that's just going to burn it. So you probably wouldn't plant that one on a north-facing slope, which gets even more sun than basically anywhere else in the garden.
Yeah, well, I guess it depends on what part of the country you live in. So, you know, afternoon sun is usually hotter, or from, you know, especially if it's out in full sun and it's surrounded by a paved area or has a metal fence behind it, it's going to get a lot hotter than it would if it was a plant out in the open in a parkland.
So I think of part shade being, you know, more than 6 hours of sun. Like if it's got less than 6 hours of sun, that's now getting into moderate shade.
Yeah.
And then, you know, if you've got heavy shade, well, then that's most of the day in the shade. If you've got dappled sun, that is an interesting one, because that to me means that it's underneath a tree where it's like filtered through the tree and it's like little specks of sunlight throughout the day. And that's an interesting one that you'll sometimes see on plant labels too.
Exactly. Okay. So now let's look at our September issue.
We're getting into spring now.
We're definitely into spring, and advanced trees was the main feature on that topic. Look, I'm torn between two articles in this particular edition. One was by Gabrielle Stannis, and she writes, the topic of hers, which is page 6, Future Trees and Climate Change, How Not to Lose Our Cool.
Huh, that's a great title.
Yeah, now that goes for 4 pages, page 6, 7, 8 and 9 of the September issue. So Gabrielle's introduction to this article says, with a PhD in the impacts of climate on vegetation and trees and a diploma of arboriculture, University of Adelaide adjunct lecturer Dr. Stefan Caddy-Ritalik is well placed to speak on the impact of climate change on our urban trees. Similarly qualified, TreeNet director Dr. Tim Johnson shares his passion for improving urban forests in Adelaide and in cities and towns across Australia. So at the University of Adelaide's Waite Arboretum, which I've been there, it's a lovely place actually. Their arboretum is absolutely fantastic. They provide an invaluable resource to better understand which trees can survive in Adelaide's changing climate, as the trees planted there are not watered after establishment. So they have to look at what trees are going to survive the impacts of climate change. And she also talks about Dr. Kate Delaporte and their team. They've assembled a database of around 550,000 trees across 19 Adelaide councils. I remember when I went to the Waite Arboretum, Dr. Kate Delaporte was doing a lot of work on eucalyptus species, particularly all those grafted ones. So she's a bit of an expert when it comes to eucalypts. So, yes, they look at all the different trees. And so I think it's such a in-depth article. It's well worth reading if this is part of your interest or if you're a planner and you're looking to see what trees to plant. She talks about TreeNet and urban forest literature database, an urban tree trials database, and she gives lots of references to the CSIRO's climate analog tool as well. So she's got a little breakout box with extra resources there. So that's a really fantastic article done by Gabby. And also the other article was Garden Trees, The Choices We Make by Patrick Renault. And he lives in the opposite end of the country to Gabby. Gabby lives in Tasmania and Patrick lives up near the Northern Rivers area. So their experiences would be quite different. So in Patrick's article, he says there is a big emphasis on planting trees in gardens, parks and streets to help cool down our towns and cities and to reduce the need for air conditioning. Whilst trees bring great benefits, we also need to be smart and mostly practical about which trees to use, where to plant them and how to look after them. Because often, too often you see, you go along and there's been a new building or development and trees have been planted and then nobody comes along and looks after them and they die because nobody's watering them to get them established. Once they're established, you know, they're usually okay if you make the right selection. So his article is on page 36 and 37, not quite as long as Gabby's article, but it's a very interesting read. And sometimes a small article is a hard one to write because you want to say a lot of things, but you can't, so you have to condense it and be succinct.
I think it was Thomas Jefferson who said, "I would have written a shorter letter, but I didn't have the time."
Yeah, that's a good, very good quote.
Going back to Patrick's article there, Karen, yeah. I'm a horticulturist and worked most of my career in maintenance. So, I mean, no offense to the maintenance crews when I say this, but we're often not equipped to maintain the trees. So in your budget or in council budgets and in client budgets, they need to include the tree maintenance as a separate budget. Because I'm the guy who comes and I'll trim the hedges and I'll spray for weeds and I'll top up the mulch and I'll, you know, try and have a look at identifying pests and diseases and do my integrated pest management plan. But when it comes to formatively pruning trees, I think most of the time it's best left to an arborist, not the maintenance crew. And it's not cheap. Planting 1,000 or 1,000,000 trees sounds great on paper, but if they're not establishing, we're better off just not even planting them.
Yeah. Well, like quite often you see the local council, I mean, not far from where I live, there's a few streets away, there's a main road that they're widening and there have been for the last 12 months and some sections of it they've planted out. But I see the truck going along every couple of days, you know, giving it a bit of water, which is good to see. So as you say, it needs to be factored in, and I think in some cases it probably is and other cases it doesn't. But, yeah, if you're a designer, a landscape designer, and or the person that's going to do the install, you know, you need to factor in that maintenance, even if you say, well, let me look after it for 6 months or 3 months or whatever it is. So, yeah, it's because sometimes you can have the opposite effect. I know when I had a landscaping business for a while, I had a client that I put a watering system in, and we were very careful because some parts of the garden were planter boxes. So we made sure we get the timing right. But the fellow, the owner, kept coming out and putting a couple of extra buckets of water on the planter boxes every day.
Yeah.
So the plants rotted.
Yeah.
So, you know, I have to factor that into my budget, yeah. You know. So.
Replacing plants. And,
yeah.
While we're on the topic of established trees, maintenance crews driving over roots as well. I mean, let's not even go into it, but that's definitely a no-no.
Yes. Yeah.
Topic for another day. Well, we've covered that subject many times on this podcast.
Yes, and also, you know, especially when they drive over it when the soil's wet.
Oh, yeah. It's even worse. And mowing crews are bad at it. You know, a lot of the civil maintenance crews, like coming to take graffiti off of the park or whatever, they'll just park on the grass, and you know, you don't realize just how far those tree roots go, and so you're effectively compacting that soil, and so on.
Yeah, exactly.
So we're moving into the middle of spring now with the October issue.
We are, and look, I've got to tell you, October was jam-packed, and there's quite a lot of different articles. The main feature was mass planting and revegetation, but you know, we've got articles on native plants. Gabby wrote about native plants. We've got the green infrastructure as well, and somebody who's talked about hedging. Oh, and that's where you started your 10 pathways in, or part two of your 10 pathways in amenity horticulture. So you're still in there and keeping us informed about the jobs. But I'd also like to give a mention to John Corbin. John Corbin is a business coach, and the title of his article, his article's usually a half a page or three quarters of a page, but each month it's something different. And in this particular one, he talks about, the title is Are You in a Rut Running Your Business, on page 33. And you know, it really doesn't matter. He does tend to, his business is, he specializes in landscape, coaching landscape owners, landscape business owners. But with, as with most business skills, you have to have the skill, everyone, that, there are basic skills, sorry, to running a business. And so, you know, he talks about changing your surroundings and some routines to help refresh your daily life. So what he's talking about is if you keep doing the same thing over and over again, nothing changes. So he talks about, you know, taking a break and changing your approach and talking to an advisor from time to time. So just wanted to give a little bit of a shout out to John there, because whilst we have our main features, he's constantly in the background there, giving a little bit of advice on to business owners, because, you know, when you have your own business, you have to be wear many hats, you know, the manager, the marketing person, the secretary, the treasurer, all of those things. So, yeah, and we also have news buds each month, and in the October edition there was quite a few great news buds, one from the Royal Botanic Gardens in Victoria that discovered a new species of fungi, and another one in Victoria where an extinct plant species was rediscovered in Victoria's Mallee. So we do get these little media things that come through that some, you know, some get a look in and some don't, but I thought those particular ones were really good. And there's another one on creating a community tree nursery from an abandoned allotment. So the news buds are also good to keep your eyes open and have a little bit of a read. And we also each month carry the nursery paper. Sorry, every second month we carry the nursery industry papers. And this particular month in the October when they talk about the red, what to look for with it and how to control or look out for red imported fire ants, which is a huge topic in the news at the moment.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that was October, almost to the end of the year. We got November. And our November was professional development, education and upskilling. And
that's my kind of topic, Karen.
It is, because you had six more pathways in amenity horticulture in there. So you,
yeah, I started doing some articles where I just showed like a bird's eye view of the industry, and I sort of started off with 10, and then it really just blew out because I was like, well, I can't talk about this part without talking about that part, and it ended up being 3 or 4 months that I just sort of stuck with that, didn't it?
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing is that the industry's so varied and diverse that, you know, you could keep changing every few years and live 100 years. You know what I mean? There's that many different ways to go.
Well, Karen, in my career, like I was on the tools and I thought that my career pathway would be either manager or starting my own business. And it's just simply not the truth. Like there are just so many different ways to go, whether you're going, you know, like what would be traditionally thought of as up the career ladder or even just lateral moves into different parts of the industry.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can build this really interesting career pathway. It doesn't have to be so static. And that's what I'm trying to do with the Hort People website as well, is show people like, hey, you can start here. Just because you have a job now in maintenance doesn't mean that you can't move over into green infrastructure or you can't move over into construction. Like you take those skills with you.
Exactly. In fact, John Fitzsimmons on page 9, 10 and 11, that's it, 9 to 11, the title of his article is Negotiating the Career Lattice. So it's exactly what you just talked about.
He had some really good lines in that article.
Yeah. You know, why? Career change. Why? Why would you want to do it? But he says whether your working life is just beginning or is somewhere further along, while the initial vision might be climbing the career ladder, the reality could well be negotiating the career lattice. An individual's journey to a rewarding and satisfying working life could be via either way, either route. It's the outcome that counts.
I think that's my favourite article for the whole year. I really love that article.
Did you?
Just the image of a lattice rather than a ladder is so powerful.
Yeah, and, you know, he talks about, you know, how to work with the change, and he talks about taking your skills with you. So every time you move, you're taking a different set of skills with you and learning and moving into an area you learn another set of skills. And I know myself, I've worked in lots of different sectors of the industry and I've learned something from all of them. So by the time I'm 100, I might know a fair bit.
Oh, you know enough to know that you don't know it all, that's for sure.
Yeah, well, that's right. Nobody knows it all. I used to work in an advisory area in a big horticultural company, and we had 8 horticulturists, and I used to say, none of us know it all, but between us we can figure it out.
Yeah.
You know, so.
John Mason from ACS Distance Education and also the Australian Garden Council was telling me a story once about how he had a plant problem, and I can't remember what it was, but he brought it to an arborist. He brought it to a botanist. He brought it to a horticulturist and a landscaper, and everyone came up with these vastly different ideas that probably all would have worked.
Yeah.
Just different approaches.
Yeah, exactly right, you know. When I worked in that department, I'd often listen to what the talkback radio, and people would ring in and ask a question, and I would compare what I thought, like to myself, what advice would I have given? Because when I worked in that job, we took calls from all over the country. So you could be in a tropical area, you could be outback Australia, you could be down in Tasmania. And, you know, in those days we didn't have smartphones and stuff that you could say, right, send me an image, you know. So it was definitely a process of elimination. So, but, yeah, all good skills, and I certainly learned a lot in that job.
Actually, Karen, while we're talking about talkback radio, I think my version of that would be Reddit. So do you know the app Reddit?
Yes, I haven't used it.
Yeah, you know, it is what you make of it. Some of it's pretty bad. Like, for example, the forum r/plants, you go on there and you see the questions people ask and the answers that they get back are truly bad. It's like you see this pothos that's clearly overwatered and people are being like, water it more. Or, you know, they've just transplanted it into a pot that's too big or blah, blah, blah. You know, you can tell as a horticulturist what they did wrong, but the answers are really bad. But it's a really fun exercise to go through and be like, well, this is what I think. And then you read the answers and it actually helps you find nuance because sometimes you will find that answer that you think, oh, that's right. But then if you go over to r/irrigation, like these guys really know what they're talking about. And I'm just sitting there watching and learning. Like I've got nothing more to say. Or r/landscaping is another really good one. Or r/turf. You know, once you get into these niches, people really know what they're doing.
Yeah. Okay. And now we come to the lucky last December-January issue. And our feature topic was greenhouses, equipment, and artificial intelligence. And I have one absolute standout article here. There's a lot of other good ones. But this particular article written by Gabrielle Stanis is called Generative AI, Fake It Till You Make It. And it goes from page 14 to 19. Absolutely fantastic. So she talks about, I'll read the intro. Are you the only one in your circle who is not using AI? Are you wondering how it may be incorporated into your horticultural or landscape design business? Generative AI may be able to help you create text or images to use in your business operations, in brackets, administration and marketing, or design, in brackets, content visualizations. Read on to find out what is happening in this space and how you can get a start on using some of these tools to save you time. So she talks about all the different platforms that you can use. And then she's got a breakout box on how it can be used in landscape design. Got another breakout box saying, how should I acknowledge that I have used AI to generate an image? Some tips on how to help you make the most of it. Look, it's just the article is so in-depth and it really explains everything so well and all the different options. In fact, we had so much feedback about this article, about how well it was written and researched, that, you know, it was a real pat on the back to Gabby because she obviously really researched the topic so well. And I've been witnessing some of the stuff her and her partner have been doing in their business just recently, using 3D images and everything in her designs. Like, it's just above my comprehension. I'd need to really start from scratch and have to teach, probably have to spend 12 months teaching me how to use it. But yeah, using 3D images, integrating AI generated images into existing photos. So it's a really fabulous, fabulous article.
And a fabulous topic.
Yeah, well, and John Fitzsimmons wrote one about greenhouses, AI and robots and time to adjust our thinking, because it does take, well, aside from any expense, but for people who have been doing things in a certain way for, you know, a decade or two or more, sometimes getting your head around these things is not easy. So he talks about that. And yeah, so look, and I think I was so pleased that, because it was a cracker of an article that Gabby sent through, and a big one, and the fact that it was in that issue allowed people more time to read it, and which is, you know, not to take away that, I mean, it's not very often people sit down and write to tell you how wonderful an article is. In fact, they're more likely to email if there's a spelling mistake. But you know, it was really such a fantastic article. In fact, I would say that would be my favourite article of the year.
Wow.
So thank you very much to Gabrielle Stannis. So, yeah, that sort of sums it up, and I think I felt pretty exhausted after all that and needed a bit of a break.
So, yeah, you take the December time off, yeah, to spend time with family and start thinking about the February issue in January.
You think that, but, you know, so yeah. December should be the time out, but there's just so much happening and people don't stop to think that you might be not working. But anyway, mm-hmm. That's life in the fast lane, isn't it? And
indeed.
We wouldn't have it any other way, I suppose. So, yeah, so it was a really successful year with the journal and, you know, we've been getting a real lot of feedback from people to say, you know, the magazine's just going from strength to strength, which is great because, you know, you hear all this stuff about print media dying and we're still out there. In fact, I think I wrote in my February issue this year in my editor's editorial that, you know, people are finding that there's a little bit of a claw back to print media because, and also some other research has come through that people actually retain things better when they read something from on paper rather than on a screen. You retain it better, you're less distracted. So, you know, that's all good for people like us that work in the print media business, and
yeah,
so it's been really, really good feedback. And in fact, this morning I was talking to someone early this morning, and they mentioned, is social media going to die because of, so getting back to artificial intelligence, so it has its good uses, but because of the deep fake news that's out there and the effects that it has on elections, and, you know, we're coming up to it, a big election next year and or this year, and you think if people really want to rely on getting information that's solid, is that going to be good for our print industry? Maybe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's vetted, isn't it? I mean, just the fact that it's committed to print, you know, and it's edited. And it goes through several layers of fact checking.
Yes, yes, that's right. So it's interesting to see where that's all going to take us, I suppose.
Well, I have a lot to say about that, but maybe I'll have to have a talk with someone like Gabby who can go through the nuances of AI and stuff like that, because I'm incredibly interested in this. And if you want to get started with AI and you don't know where to get started, definitely check out that December issue of the journal and go onto ChatGPT, just Google ChatGPT and have an existential conversation with it. Just talk to it like it's a person and you'll be blown away.
Yeah, well, she, you know, she talks about the different platforms that are out there that you can use. And in that article, she talks about, you know, getting started, I suppose, you know, where it all begins. And she talks about Microsoft Bing Chat and Google Bard chatbots, and of course the OpenAI's ChatGPT.
Yeah, ChatGPT, yeah.
Yeah.
So many different options. And also a lot of them run off of the different ones. So you'll have something like Jasper, which is set up for like writing different types of content using the ChatGPT engine. So it gets quite complex, and, you know, there are jobs emerging now as prompt engineers, people who can write the right questions to help you get the outputs that you want.
Yeah.
It's an incredibly exciting area.
I heard something on the news recently about artificial intelligence has developed or come up with a recipe, I suppose you might want to call it, for some sort of a fungal problem, and for humans. But I was thinking, could this be something that it could be used for, you know, in nursery?
Well, let's put it this way. Absolutely. So, you know, a human being has read however many books in their life. Like I probably read, I have no idea, maybe a few hundred books tops, like not even. AI has access to every single book ever written. So when a human being can access a certain bank of knowledge to ask the question, AI can put together these tangential ideas that no one's ever put together before and then be like, yeah, well, maybe you need to look at this research from this botanist and combine it with the work of this permaculturist and this arborist. And then, you know, this is an interesting little corner here between these three pieces of research. Like, this is where you need to start. Read these three books. And maybe you would not have known that those three pieces of content even exist, let alone how to put them together.
Mm. Well, I think Gabby's probably the person that you should be interviewing next because, you know, my knowledge of this is pretty limited. So, yeah, I'd suggest you do that.
Absolutely. You know?
And, look, even some of the stuff that she's doing for her own business, she's a little gem.
Mm-hmm. Karen, the main thing that I noticed throughout all of these articles we've talked about are the practicality for the industry. So there are some gardening magazines out there and they're really good. They're like inspirational and they're philosophical and they get a bit of fire in the belly. But the thing that really strikes me is that I can put all of this to use.
Mm. Well, that's because our magazine is targeted at people who work in the industry. It's a business-to-business magazine as opposed to a consumer magazine. So the consumer magazine is going to tell people how they can, you know, build a garden bed and plant a veggie patch and that type of thing, which is fabulous. But where our audience is people who already know how to do that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's quite a different audience, I suppose. Well, definitely is a different audience.
Yeah.
I mean, we certainly hope that particularly young people or people looking at career change can benefit from the articles and learn. It's all part of your ongoing learning. I mean, you know yourself, you go to a different event from a different sector of the industry, you learn a little bit from this and a little bit from that and more from other people, and then you read articles and, you know, books, mm-hmm. whatever. So, yeah, we'd like to think that it's a great tool for people and that they can use it and read it and take that information on board and use it in their business.
Absolutely. So, Karen, is there anything else you'd like the listeners to know about?
Yes, one little thing for anybody who's in the industry and holding events. We do on the Hort Journal website have an events page because I couldn't tell you how many things I can't attend this year because they're overlapping with other industry things. Mm-hmm. So, and on that note, I suppose that's all related. You want me to say something that's unrelated, don't you?
No, it's a spot to plug, a spot to advocate a change in the world, or just it's your free time. It's just whatever you think that we should know about. So that pretty much hits it spot on. And we'll put a link in the show notes for that events page.
Yeah, because you hate to think I hate to think I'm missing out on an event that I'd like to go to.
Yeah.
But two, like, for example, the Melbourne Flower Show this year being on at the same time as the Grand Prix has quadrupled the cost of accommodation, you know. Mm. So having, I mean, the Melbourne Flower Show is always on at the same time. So, yeah, other than that, just be kind to people.
No, that's a beautiful message to end it on, Karen. Mm. Thank you so much for a great chat.
Thank you.
If you resonated with the topics we talked about in this episode, check the show notes for a link to subscribe to Hort Journal Australia. You can read articles online as well as having them shipped straight to your door each month. The quality of articles is truly impressive. And as a writer, I can attest to just how high the bar is for submissions. If you or somebody that you know is looking for a professional horticulture writer to help grow your business, I've been doing it for a few years now, including print articles, advertorials, and SEO-focused blog articles. I've been able to get some pretty great results for my clients, so don't be shy and say g'day via LinkedIn or email at hello@plantsgrowhere.com. I'd like to work with landscape companies, nurseries, landscape architects, and similar businesses.